Welcome to minute 47 of season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Kurt Kenny, award-winning producer, director, writer, composer, filmmaker. Welcome back to the show, Kurt.
Thank you.
We had a lot of fun talking about food yesterday, but today we're going to move away from food. We'll try to find some other interesting things to talk about that are not food related. So episode 47 begins with Al acknowledging the dispatch call and ends with John reaching the door. So yesterday we ended things with Al leaving the AMPM on his way to his car. And, you know, he acknowledges the call that they're sending him to Nakatomi. He goes, 8 Lincoln 30 to dispatch. I'm on my way. And then he starts walking towards the car. Now, one of the things that I noticed, which is really funny, if you look even in the first second of this minute, the door to his police car is not closed. It's slightly ajar.
Really?
You think,
I guess, okay, he was just sloppy in closing it, yeah.
Yeah, you'd think he'd be concerned that someone's going to, you know, steal his police car or something. You know, that's actually a production error, I guess you can say. Yeah. I don't think it was really Al, but still, it's funny that if you look at it that way.
This first shot, though, is a really nice piece of staging, though, because it does everything you need visually all in one image. It's funny. I'm guessing this gas station is probably still there, actually, because they give you a way to know exactly where it is too. Because he's all in one shot. He's walking out. He stops, throws the thing in the car, and then we just pan over with him. And then suddenly, right in the frame is the Nakatomi Building, which is just, you know, it's so visually economical that it's just like, you know, no one has to cut, no one has to do anything. It's just, it's all in the one frame that you know, the choosing of that location and the working out of that shot. I mean, all that you had to figure out in pre-production, that this is a place where we can get this all in one shot, you know, because it's the whole reason you choose that particular gas station is to get this particular shot right here that Al can just step, like, you know, 4 steps from his car and he's looking up and we have a perfect shot of the building there.
Right. And we can even see the name of the road. He's on the corner of Bellwood Avenue.
Yeah. Bellwood. Yeah. So it's,
I wonder how far away Bellwood is from
very, very well chosen location, because that is you couldn't do any more economically or better with that moment as far as just, you know, staging that. It's so everything you need just in one image, and also just kind of an interesting thing, you know, given the passage of time to see what the price of gas is in the shot, which is
that always amazes me when I see that.
That's it makes one very nostalgic for those prices, but
completely
there it is. And then that's followed by actually another great oneer as well too, because the shot right after that when they come out of the gas station is, it's because you were talking earlier about the number of cuts in the first thing, but we come out of it, we did this one shot coming over to the building, and then on the top of the building, it's, you know, you start with the bad guys and then it comes over in one shot over to Bruce Willis and is kind of this high tracking shot moving over and then goes off of Bruce Willis onto Carl up on the roof, walking toward the smoke piles and everything. It's just a really beautifully staged shot that you can, in one moment, you know, you see where everybody is, you know, geographically where everybody is in relation to each other. You can, you know, also get the sense of how high up they are, because we're looking down, you can see the lights of the city below them, and it's got all the smoke in the foreground, everything too. It's just a great, great, great piece of staging, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Jan Davant did an amazing job with this movie. There's no question about that.
Well, the staging would be John McTiernan, who directed, because he's the one who's like, okay, we'll go from here, go from here. But yeah, Jan Davant lit it beautifully, though, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the way that it all just plays out and stuff like that. Right. So, I mean, we mentioned the fact earlier that what Al does is he goes and he takes the bag of Twinkies, throws it into the car, and then it's funny that he throws them in. I mean, that's something that would probably get mashed really easily. You know, it's not as if he really, you know, you'd think that one would be a little more cautious. I mean, we're not talking about glass, but still something that, you don't want to get too mushed along the way, or the the whole way, just the way that he tosses it in there, whatever. And then he walks towards the street. And this is actually, it's funny. I've always noticed the sign with the price for gas, but I never paid attention to the fact that he's actually at a gas station. You know, that the AMPM is a gas station. This is the first time that I noticed that.
Because their AMPMs are everywhere out here, so I just, you know, it's not something I think about. But yeah, I guess if you don't have them there, that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. No, because in my mind, it's like a 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven doesn't mean that it's going to have a, you know, a pump there, you know, a gas pump.
AMPM is pretty much always attached to like an ARCO station or something like that.
So. Yeah, okay. That's fair. That's so then we see the sign that shows the gas prices, as you mentioned earlier. You know that regular is 74.9 and unleaded is 77.9, which so I did a little bit of research about this. So what was the average price per gallon in both 1987 and 1988? All right, because we're never 100% sure if this movie is supposed to take place on December 24th, 87 or 88. Okay, because in 1988, December 24th was a Saturday night, or was a Saturday.
Okay.
Meaning that the big question is are they having this party on a Friday night or a Saturday night? You know, is it the end of the workday, or is it that they're working on Saturday and that they're coming in then? You know, but either way, it doesn't make sense that Takagi said earlier when they wake up in Japan, they're going to change things, or they wake up in Tokyo, they're going to change the codes because, you know, nobody should be working either on a Saturday or a Sunday, you would think. But these are all minor tidbits.
I'm assuming if it's, you know, supposed to be Christmas 1988, what day of the week was that? Let's see.
No, that's what I'm saying. Christmas 1988 was the 25th was on a Sunday. So Christmas Eve.
Yeah, okay.
So Christmas Eve is Saturday night. So that's why. It makes a little more sense that maybe it's Friday night, but you never know. You know, it could be that they're all just workaholics that want to work. it could be either way. It doesn't really make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I check things, I'm checking both 87 and 88 just to be as completionist as possible from that perspective. So the average price per gallon in 1987 was 90 cents. Which is really strange, and this is all across the whole country, okay. But I mean, so this means that in LA, if you were getting gas, you could do a pretty good job of getting more for your money back then, right? Which 90 cents in 1987 money is worth $1.67 today, due to inflation. And if it was 1988, so then it was also 90 cents, but the inflation would say that it was $1.62. Because I guess inflation went down between 87 and 88. So $1.62 compared to how much did you pay recently for gas? Do you have any idea?
$6.25 last time I was at the pump.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean the national average.
That's what it is here in Los Angeles right now.
Right. Exactly. So I did a search on that of what's. You know, going according to today's numbers, okay, just to let everyone, you know, look behind the curtain, today is July 12th. So on July 12th, 2022, the average price of a gallon of gas in the U.S., okay, and it obviously in different states, it's going to be different things, but the average taking all 50 states into account is $4.65, okay, but the high end goes up to $6. And the low end goes up to $4.16, depending on, you know, in the southern states, in Texas and Florida and a lot of the southern states. So the prices range there between $4.16 and $4.38. And then, you know, and on the West Coast, it goes up to the highest between $4.98 and $6.05. So... You know, you said you paid.
I've seen stations out here with like $7, and I don't go to them. I've there are other ones that are closer to $6.
Right.
But yeah, like last night I was driving by this one station. It was anywhere between like $6.25, $6.35, something like that for the premium.
Well, so. See, I live in a country that the gas prices are regulated so that every single gas station has to have the same price. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
So, that's interesting. You know, so, no, because I mean, I grew up in Detroit and I remember, you know, that there would be two gas stations across the street from each other that would have different prices. And I always said to myself, why would someone go to the one that's even a cent more? You know, you know, ever since I lived here in Israel, I never had that problem. You don't have to like think of where you want to go. It doesn't matter. It's all the exact same price, but it's in a different currency. So I'm not even going to try to figure out, you know, what's more expensive. And also here they do it via liters as opposed to gallons. So quite different, but I think it cost me about maybe $75 or $80 if you try and translate it to dollars, you know, every time I fill up, and I have a small car, so I think that the prices are higher here than in America. So so then first of all, the panning shot, as you mentioned earlier, is great. You know, the way that it just shows us, you know, the entire grandeur also of the Nakatomi building, because it also pans up, you know, Alice standing there and looking up, and, you know, you see it all go up. And then what's really interesting also is that you see the blinking lights on the top. And to me, this was a great storytelling shot, because we know what's going on the top floor there. You know, where these lights are flashing, you know, there are gunshots that are happening. And, you know, it is 40 stories up, so you're not going to be able to see everything the same way that you can see them from down below. Yep. So, you know, he's not able to see what's going on there, because if he was, he would call and say, okay, this isn't a grand call. Something really is going on there.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the idea that the audience knows something that the character doesn't know is always great, you know, from that perspective, because we want to see how he's going to find things out, you know, stuff like that. And then the shot quickly changes to the rooftop, where we see Franco and Fritz, you know, trying to move John along, you know, to herd him in a certain direction or whatever it is. And that we see that they're shooting at him, but they constantly are missing. You know, apparently Hans didn't hire the right people if he wants to have people who know how to shoot well. Nobody has, that's, you know, Hans is
the hiring department.
That's right. The only two people who have managed to actually hit anything is when using a handgun a few inches away from someone's head. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Carl killed the second security guard without, you know, he was a little further away, but still, you know. And first of all, I love the layout of the roof, because we see that it's all zigzagged around, you know, as the shots are taking, they're shooting at each other and stuff like that. So there's always some place for someone to hide as, you know, as things are moving along and stuff like that. You know, you can basically see though that John, Fritz and Franco are all completely shooting blindly. They're not hitting anything. They don't, you know, they don't really care about apparently what they're trying to hit, because, you know, one of the good things about living in the movie world, or maybe, you know, this also from the TV world, you know, that you have magical, you know, clips in guns that will shoot as many bullets as you need, you know, that, so
yeah,
did they do that on the Blacklist also?
They try to keep it realistic, I think, for the most part.
Okay,
they have a really really good armor on that show. This guy named Joel who is just top notch with safety, which is very important, as we
all. Yes.
Everyone got a big lesson in that after the
yeah
the whole fiasco with Alec Baldwin's Western, but yeah.
Yeah. So right. So the shot pans up, and we get to see the helicopter pad, where we see Carl calmly walking across, you know, trying to, you know, to find a way to pick off John, you know, who doesn't know that he's up there, you know. Yep. And they the and also the shot, if you look at it, you see You see the blinking lights. You see the muzzle flashes. You see the gunshots. And as it's all coming together, you see you also can hear the music. You know, the music changes tempo at this point. You know, adding to the suspense and thrilling aspects of everything that's going on. And then we get McClane screaming out, "Christ!" You know, and he's shooting randomly as he's walking backwards. He probably doesn't have much experience with machine guns. You know, as a detective, he probably just uses his pistol most of the time, but you know, he still knows how to use it. And you know, then Carl, we see him once again creeping up from above. But what's really strange is he's holding his gun up. Now, obviously, if you're on a shooting range or somewhere where you don't want to accidentally shoot somebody, you're going to keep the muzzle up. But if he's trying to you know, reach a point where he can shoot somebody, you'd think that he would already walk as much as he can in the ready, you know, to be able to do.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. I don't really understand it, but yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
right. And then it goes back, and we see another shot of John just shooting blindly at everything that possible. You know, then he you know, he turns and he runs and looks over his shoulder, and he ends up backing himself up into Carl's line of fire, which is what Carl wanted. But somehow Carl seems to miss. You know, he had the perfect shot. It's a perfect shot for him and just didn't work at all.
Nope.
You know, and you know, then the way that you know, everything misses, so John is then able to find a way to take cover, and you know, it gives him a chance to change magazines, which you know, thankfully he has a second magazine that he was able to take from Tony, you know, from Tony's bag when he was shooting earlier. But again, there's no way. Most clips hold between 15 and 30 bullets. You know, he shot a lot more than that at this point, you know, before he's changed the clip there anyway. And then he...
One thing that if you see the shot where Bruce Willis is backing up, you know, and firing as he's, you know, on his way to kind of hide behind the next spot that he has to hide behind, is one thing that I just love about this movie and movies of this era that use this too. We're talking about the lenses again, but if you can see the way these kind of the flares are kind of this sort of lengthwise this time, but oval circular shape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just that's also another feature of the anamorphic lenses that were Panavision lenses at that period that I just love. Is I whenever I see those that kind of circular oval flare, I get all excited. I just like that.
Okay, that's good. That's a good thing to be excited about.
So, and also just I'm not exactly sure what's generating the smoke that's on the roof there. I guess maybe it's like New York City with the subway, they just have smoke coming up or whatever, yeah, steam. But it certainly makes Carl look cool as he's walking along.
Yes.
So it gives a good atmosphere to everything.
Yeah, so because it was probably not very...
I don't know what motivates it, but I don't really care because it just looks cool.
Yeah. So. I think that's the point, you know, that it's supposed to look cool. I think that's what they're looking for. Because it can't be from like a heating vent or something like that, because I doubt it's that cold. You know, you would know more how cold it gets in December in LA than I would, but you know, I don't think it gets that cold that you have the heat on.
Totally, you know. Totally. Yeah.
And as he, you know, switches clips, then he looks over and he sees a you know, a door that he decides to go through. So he just empties the entire clip into it. Which is, again, very funny that, you know, he just spent an entire clip running from the bad guys and shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting. And now in 2 seconds, he shoots out the next clip, you know, that he had. So.
Well, yeah. It's his escape to freedom. He's got to use his resources wisely.
So. Correct. For sure. But he's got to think that he's going to need them in the future also. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't know what's beyond that door.
I also like, though, that they went to the trouble with the squibs on this movie of having ones that have, you know, just sparks flying, which is very interesting visually to look at, rather than just boom, 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 like the door being blown open, which they could have done. Yeah.
Yeah.
The sparks, much like the smoke, just kind of add a little, just a lovely visual flair to the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then he runs towards the door and once again does his acrobatics by jumping over this. I mean, he could be in the Olympics with this type of the way that he jumps over this railing, because he's like holding with one arm and goes over it. So that's pretty impressive.
That's true.
Not something that I would have expected from Bruce Willis, even in 1988. Yeah.
Well, he was mainly known for moonlighting at that time, as I recall.
Correct. Yes. So yeah, I don't think in moonlighting he was doing moves like this.
Yeah, I remember it was a big surprise that he suddenly became an action hero.
Yes. Yes. But I think that's also one of the reasons why this movie works so well, because you don't expect him to be the action hero. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just like any of the rest of us. You know, that's the thing.
Yep.
Totally. But he's John McClane, you know, so. Mm-hmm. And basically he lands on the ground right in front of the door, and that's the way this minute ends. So did you have anything else you want to say about this minute, Kurt?
No, I think we covered it. I think it's good. Like I said, my favorite things on this one is particularly the staging of those two shots at the beginning. I think those are really strong.
Yeah. Right. So the script has another few minor discrepancies, not that many. First of all, the dispatch calls him a second time because he doesn't respond the first time, which, again, is not needed. And then it says as he's leaving the store, he burns rubber. I don't know why they would say that. Maybe because they told him it's a code 2 and that means it's urgent. I don't know.
Oh, but it's obvious why they didn't put that in the movie, because you don't need it. And when that shot comes over to see Nakatomi Plaza and you see the dancing lights of the gunfire up there, it's a perfect transition to back to the roof. So it would be stupid to cut back to the guy driving, because obviously we know he's going to drive.
Yeah. So, right. But the difference is in the script, they don't have the shot. They don't say that it, you know, you pan to the, for him looking out at the Nakatomi.
Hmm.
It does have it, but he doesn't like walk or anything. He just looks up and it says, there it is, Nakatomi in all its gleaming glory. That's all it says. And then he, you know, that's also why he didn't respond at first. He was, I guess, distracted by looking at the Nakatomi building.
Yeah. Right? Well, I guess that's probably something the director figured out looking at it, like, oh, it's a much better transition if he looks up and sees the flashes in the distance. So we know he sees there's something, and boom, we go to the thing. I think that's just something he'd figure out, like, oh, we don't need that. Right. Just do this.
Okay. So, Makes sense. Right, and then it has a description of John on top of the roof. It says, running for his life from Fritz and Franco, he doesn't realize he's being herded around the building towards Carl. Suddenly, McLean turns a corner and sees Carl. The big man fires a burst, and McLean ducks back, stopping at the exterior door to the pump room he used before. It is locked from the inside. And then it says that he blows off the lock with a burst from the machine gun.
But, yeah, I guess that's true. That the one leap that you make here is that he wouldn't necessarily know that that door was locked before he's shooting off the lock. But I guess maybe he's just making sure, because he's only going to get one shot at going at it.
Right.
So
exactly.
But it is true that he didn't like get up and try the lock or anything like that. Yeah. So
yeah, but he's panicking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, you know, does he look over? Let me take one more look at that. He looks over.
He looks over it and he sees it, but he doesn't really, he's not really paying attention to what's there. We just see him, he's trying to figure out what to do. He just looks over there.
I guess it's a fair assumption that it would be locked, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, tomorrow we'll find out what that door is.
He's not going to get a chance to go over there and pull on the lock because he's being fired at in that alley. So yeah.
Right. That's true. Also. Right. All right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story of an adventure, misadventure, something that might have happened at some point during their lives over something that's related to the holidays. So you got a story for us, Kurt?
I don't know that it's a misadventure per se, but it's related to this movie, which is that we, over Christmas this last year, it was hard. I was at my sister's house with her family and my folks, and it was hard to get anybody to agree on anything to watch. Particularly my nephews are older now, for Christmas Eve when we wanted to like sit down and watch a movie after dinner. And so we actually ended up watching Die Hard on Christmas Eve. And I don't think either of my parents had ever seen it before.
Oh, wow.
And I think they liked it, but I think they were in kind of shock as to how violent this movie was that we were watching on Christmas Eve. So
little did they know that you saw it when you were 14.
Well, I saw it when I was 14. My parents never did.
You know, no, I know that. But I'm saying your parents didn't know that you saw it when you were 14. Them being
just being shocked, like, this is what we're watching on Christmas.
Okay. Not shocked at. Oh, okay. Sorry, I misunderstood that. I thought you meant shocked at the amount of violence.
Yeah, so. And I do remember, this is kind of just related to what I'm doing now, is this isn't in the sequences we're watching, but in the downstairs portion of, you know, down in the lobby, you know, they keep cutting back to the bad guy who was put on point in the lobby.
Eddie.
Is that a lot of people mistake him for Huey Lewis.
And you're wearing a Huey Lewis shirt right now that only I can see. But yeah.
I'm making a documentary about Huey Lewis and his hearing disorder. I've been following him around for 3 years now. So everyone in my world knows that, like, that, you know, I'm kind of the resident Huey Lewis expert now because I've been following Huey around for 3 years and, you know, filming him. And so it's just funny because that became a big point of discussion. Is that Huey Lewis? That is not Huey Lewis. Huey did not act in Die Hard. No, I'm pretty sure that's Huey. That, it looks like Huey. It's not Huey.
Do you know who I think the original security guard looks like? Do you remember what the guy looks like, the original security guard who gets shot at the beginning?
I don't remember the scene right off. So,
okay, so no, I always think that that's listen. I always think that that's John Larroquette.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, I could see that. Sure.
Yeah. All right, great. So you want to tell people once again how they can get in touch with you?
My website, which is my name, just KURTKUENNE.com, and there's a contact button on there.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is quite simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website. You can find me on Facebook, or you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.